Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric. Excuse me, I'm choking on memes right now. I'm here with Michael, who fills my messages window with wonderful, wonderful things. How you doing, man?
This is
the longest I've gone without talking to you for...
Yeah, it's been 9 days.
Been a couple extra days than usual.
Not even 9 whole days.
Busy time in the valley, man. We got a few movies on Double Feature that we're going to spoil and people should use chapters.
Yep.
But we want to talk a lot about this pairing.
All right. So we're doing Gone with the Wind, and we're doing it with The Wizard of Oz. But I need to point this out to you, Eric.
Yeah, please.
Before we get too far into it. This wasn't my first choice.
Right.
Gone with the Wind, that was a Kickstarter listener's choice.
Yes, that is Brianna's choice.
Right.
And thanks a ton to her again for helping out. I know we're thanking people all the time. We have so many people who were kind enough to help us. Bree gave us a couple options, but we definitely wanted to go with Gone with the Wind.
Well, okay, so we went with Gone with the Wind before I realized it was 4 hours long.
Right, yes.
And you can attest that was a terrible shock to me.
So what we've got, let me give you the actual double feature for a second.
Uh-huh.
We have a Victor Fleming double feature to make this even crazier,
right,
on our show today. And we wanted to cover these colossal sort of classic films and have a show, I guess... Now that we have this director on the show, it's pretty great because it's a director we might not have covered otherwise.
Right.
And so people will definitely look at our lineup so far this year, and I think this is one of those shows that sticks out as, oh, that's kind of an interesting thing, you know, given what they usually talk about. But I should say he also did the Ingrid Bergman, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde from 41.
Right.
So I don't want to say no hope to ever show up on double feature, but let's do these huge, colossal things all in the same, the same week.
But we didn't pick it because it was the same director. In fact, I didn't know it was the same director until I was maybe 5 minutes into Gone. Well, okay, 5 minutes after the overture of Gone with the Wind.
Sure.
And I'm sitting there watching it going, this looks
like
Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, yeah.
So we didn't pick it because of Victor Fleming. We picked it for a much higher brow rationale.
Yeah, please.
So we were told to do Gone with the Wind, and so we were going to pick a film that went along with it. And obviously my first choice was Twister.
This is the You Almost Got Twister episode of Double Feature. Thankfully... We have a little more tact than that, but man, as we pair these things.
Slightly. Yeah, we just picked a movie that doesn't have the tornado in the name.
Yeah.
That's all we did. I picked Wizard of Oz because I was like, oh no, it's an old timey movie with a tornado.
Right. It's still got a wind joke is the point here. Oh man, you have no idea how often we, and the real showstopper for that is we go Twister. Yeah. Can we talk about Twister for 20 minutes? Wizard of Oz might be easier. Let's do that. We get ourselves in trouble that way. All right. So anyways, I already gave a fucking spoiler warning. Don't get spoiled on these two huge movies everyone but us has seen. So having the problem we always have with giant movies other people have heard of and seen more than once, I want to have these very strange conversations about both of the films today. And with Gone with the Wind... something that intrigues me right away is the color palette.
Yeah.
And I know it's been we discussed back on the Wes Anderson show we did with, what were the movies on that?
That was The Royal Tenenbaums and...
Cecil B. Demented, right?
Oh, right. Cecil B. Demented.
Yeah. And we had discovered, we had this kind of awakening about color in film. And as I'm, you know, thinking about these movies, especially Gone with the Wind, and a lot of what I feel like it's not credited for, or what it's not really known for. This is a movie that for as long as it is, and we see this sometimes in exploitation as the movies get longer, sometimes there's less attention that you can pay to every scene.
Right.
Because your piece is so large that you just, you there's no time. There's no there's not enough people. There's not enough money.
Well, and you run into the problem of trying to focus too much on a single artistic aspect and that starting to potentially take away from the scope of your film.
Right.
You have a 4-hour movie like Gone with the Wind, and I mean, 3 hours in, you're back at the home, but in between that, you're at war, you're traveling on the road, you're
sure.
I mean, you're in 100 different settings with 100 right. different plot points throughout this film. And so, yeah, it's
sure.
it's difficult to pay special attention to what people might deem a smaller aspect of the overall project.
So when we were talking about color last time, we talked about it to invoke certain moods. And I think another great thing that it can do, especially in an epic like this, is manage to tie the whole movie together despite how many different settings you have. Because as you're mentioning, you know, you're all over the place. You're at war and you're in this home. You're in different homes, different time periods. So by having a very distinct color palette, you can make the entire thing flow without feeling divided up, and then still give each area its own unique sort of flavor.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of remember. I mean, we talked about movie barcode, right?
Right.
It's moviebarcode.tumblr.com. You can click index on there and just look up Gone with the Wind. So looking at this right now, and this is another thing, movie barcode, for people who didn't hear that show or aren't looking at it, is essentially a quick printout of kind of all the scenes of a film and what they look like squashed together in a rectangle.
Mm-hmm.
So you could see, basically you can squint at it and see what the colors are. Also, I said I liked the untextured sort of versions last time,
yeah.
And I'm an idiot. The textured ones are better.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, I agree.
I've completely changed my mind on that. So looking at this, you can kind of see, and do this with your favorite films because it's excellent, you can sort of see the different pockets of what's going on at different times.
Right.
Gone with the Wind does pay a lot of attention to every single scene.
Right.
It really does set it up like each scene is the most important one, and we are going to take care to make sure that, you know, we're giving everything the artistic justice it deserves. And looking through this, I mean, the big one that I wrote down as I was watching it were the reds of the war scenes.
Right.
Those kind of the explosions of the ammunition and so forth. Just this end of the world that they allude to,
mm-hmm.
this apocalyptic kind of feeling. And you definitely see that before the intermission, you know, you see that huge block of red, and then a brief moment before it essentially blacks out. Everything goes dark for a pretty long amount of time. But then also just paying attention to the scenes, it heavy use of silhouettes and different amounts of pooled lighting. The dark scenes are interesting to me for what's lit. You know, getting into things like the red staircase later in the movie,
mm-hmm.
which actually on the movie barcode website has its own barcode. They did one just for that scene, but how he kind of scoops her up and they disappear upstairs, you know,
right.
out of that pool of light. Just a lot of attention to detail there. He creates these really memorable places to go, you know, for as important as home is in this movie, in both of these movies, you think of the orange shot with the silhouettes. Extremely iconic, very
mm-hmm.
powerful shots.
Mm-hmm.
There's something that feels very, very epic about
right.
it. You know, this is a movie that kind of defined epics in cinema. I think all movies were epics, and Gone with the Wind happened, and maybe everybody settled down for a couple of years afterwards and made smaller films.
I think you're going to be hard pressed to have a conversation about definitive film at all, let alone definitive epics,
mm-hmm.
without talking about Gone with the Wind. Because, I mean, just of all the things, so attention to detail, which we've already been discussing, you have to keep in mind that they interviewed over 1,000 women on who was going to play Scarlett O'Hara.
Sure.
They waited 3 or 4 years. They stalled production that long until Clark Gable was available
yeah.
to play Rhett Butler, because they just... Victor Fleming would not accept these people not being
sure.
exactly right. And it pays off. The film costs something like $32 million to make on budget.
Mm-hmm. old-timey dollars. Right. $32 million old-timey dollars.
And they ended up making 10 times that. And adjusted for inflation, Gone with the Wind is still the most financially successful film of all time.
That's crazy.
Which is interesting to think that essentially what that translates to is it is the most seen film
sure.
in the theater
sure.
in the history of ever.
Yeah, right.
More people have seen this than The Dark Knight. More people have seen this than people who saw Avatar.
Anytime you're feeling bad about the state of cinema, right. remember that Gone with the Wind beats Avatar.
This film is one of those it's one of those rare moments in Hollywood and cinematic history where you look at the amount of work and detail and beauty and painstaking artistic yeah. integrity
sure.
buried in this film, and you go, hey, wow, that really paid off.
Yeah, it turns out all these artistic risks are completely validated. They suddenly feel worth it. Talk to me about these characters a little bit. The Clark Gable character, you know, Mr. Butler, is...
Right. The greatest male character in the history of cinema.
Right, well, that's the weird thing, and that's going to come up a lot with Gone with the Wind, is the way it's perceived... And then what I feel is actually here. I always think of, Gone with the Wind's the romance epic.
Sure.
And that's Clark Gable's character to me, is that, you know, sporting that era appropriate Stark mustache thing yeah. he's got going on.
Red Butler is Jim from The Office circa 1940.
Okay, I totally get it now.
Yeah.
I absolutely understand. Well, because you have this movie poster idea of the two of them embracing
uh-huh.
romance. And... then you get into the film and I need more time with him somehow.
Right.
I have a hard time pinning down, you know, who is Clark Gable's character.
Right.
I see how he affects the other characters. But, you know, if you ask me to explain what Clark Gable's character looks like against, I guess, out of the context of Scarlett O'Hara, I'm not sure I can do that.
Rhett Butler kind of comes off as the wrong guy.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a popular colloquialism that is the bad guy gets the girl, but she brings the good boy home or something like that.
Okay,
you know what? Are you familiar with this
phrase? I understand the idea, the principle.
Right. And so Clark Gable and Jim Halpert, for the record, from The Office, get to be both. And that's why they run the largest gamut of wet panties. Because they get to be the snarky bad boy who, in Jim's case, plays pranks. In Rhett Butler's case, is a total asshole and sure. gets to just randomly go off to war.
Right.
But at the end of the day, they're caring and considerate and capable of taking care of these women when they need them. But they're not the type of guy who is going to pave the way for the woman. They're totally comfortable with the woman being an individual and probably prefer if they follow their own path, and they're happy to walk next to them. And that's what gets the panties wet.
So I love Scarlett as that kind of independent woman, or the woman maybe struggling for independence.
Mm-hmm.
It's a weird thing because until the last second, I go back and forth on, does Scarlett resemble independence? She seems really, I don't know if she's unsure of herself, you know, and then you think she's just tied to this man as he's leaving their home. She just seems so broken and defeated. She doesn't have anything until that very last moment, that last second where she finds something for herself and Tara, having this kind of hope and, you know, tomorrow, another day and so forth. It's as if, you know, you had ended the movie at that point. I would go, not quite the beacon of independence.
Right.
And something about that last line is redeeming about that character. Goes, okay, no, she's just, you know, she's in a moment where she's struggling.
Yeah.
So that makes me wonder, you know, finding the themes in an epic like this, I don't know. Can you even do that? How do you find a through line in something that covers, you know, decades of a person's life without just boiling that, reducing them to one thing they represent?
Well, here's what's interesting and wonderful about Gone with the Wind in finding a theme.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the losing side of the Civil War.
Okay, yeah.
The film is obviously beating you over the head with the futility of war.
which we love as pacifists, right? I mean, I think that's great.
No, it's fantastic. It's so well done in this film. But I think the best way to find the thematic arc is to take the only character who is in every scene, and that's Scarlett,
mm-hmm.
and to go, what is this story about relative to her? And I think that the reason it's so fascinating that this film and the double sleeping nap time equivalent were both set during the Civil War is that it's about finding independence within oneself.
Sure.
In a war that is probably what the second or even in America, the most primary battle for independence.
Sure. Well, it's a very American war as sure. opposed to, you know, I think about wars, especially ones we've covered on our show, and it's always World War II.
Right.
It's, I mean, 100% of the time it's World War II.
I mean, the fucking Civil War is obviously a big part of that.
Sure.
In Americans' eyes now is about the emancipation of the slaves in the South. And to the South, that seems silly and offensive and unfair. Meanwhile, we have a Southerner who can't be emancipated from her own lifestyle.
Yeah, it is interesting to think about, all right, the Civil War is clearly, you can find a theme in the Civil War, independence.
Right. Right.
I think that's a common theme of probably every war fucking ever.
Sure.
And then to see that inside Scarlett's character too, you know, that strive for independence.
Well, and the other thing I think that's so amazing about Gone with the Wind as a story is that the film is about a woman seeking her own independence, not only
sure.
as an individual, but just trying to be able to succeed as a human being, coming from a lifestyle that wouldn't allow for that.
Sure. Well, because there's a lot of traditionalism to that too.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Also the, in seeing this great amount of time, you know, from one point to another of the Civil War and how the South evolves through that, we start this movie in this very, we basically start and end in different points of aristocracy.
Sure.
You know, we kind of see women being chased and courted and everybody's trying to, you know, get fucking married and become
right.
somebody's possession. And we end the movie and, okay, this is what high aristocratic society looks like.
Sure.
You know, after.
And the reason for me that I think it's so interesting that they're doing this film is that the Civil War is about freeing blacks,
mm-hmm.
at least part of it.
Sure.
Black men got their rights before women.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have this massive war being fought, you know, the blood of the nation spilt along its fault lines.
Sure.
Meanwhile, this one individual woman can't fucking start her own business. She can't drive her own
right.
cart without people turning up their nose.
It's a chaperone.
Meanwhile, there are armies of men willing to save black people.
Yeah, the irony there of all of these people fighting the war and not addressing, you know, the equality for all.
Yeah.
And that's something I think we've gotten, you know, as we keep seeing these different struggles for civil liberties and for independence throughout time, past racial equality, past women's suffrage, you know, more presently minded gay marriage. I think every time we've gotten closer to saying equality for everyone, rather than equality for the oppressed group, we're starting to learn as a culture that, hey, a lot of people are oppressed in a lot of different ways. And while we're bringing up this one issue, really what we're talking about is the independence of the larger humanity.
Right.
You know, of all people who want all things not considered mainstream.
Yeah. So I think one of the biggest themes for Gone with the Wind is about independence to a fault. And Scarlett O'Hara embodies that so much so that her own child dies and she loses the man she truly loves.
Right.
And this is all in this fervent clamor to never be hungry again.
Yeah, figuring out an end game is another one as I'm trying to determine how you pull a theme out of an epic. You know, I think, all right, if we're going to do something almost biographical of an individual, then we have to think about what things are important to them.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of how I go, you know, if you're going to find a theme in a biography, you're going to go, who is this biography about? What things did they find important? That's where the lessons are to be learned, I guess. That's the new information. That's what's going to change your perspective on things. And so, you know, in the setting, you look at, because Scarlett's there and you're seeing what's important to her, you're thinking a bit about the traditionalism of the South, about the role of women in society there and how that's shifting. Her endgame becomes land ownership and having, you know, not having to worry about eating and having a thing for herself.
Right.
I think we've also seen this land ownership issue, you know, in a lot of wartime movies, because it is the pillar of, it's what you can rest on. It's what you can be reassured by. You have a home. And we'll definitely get to that in The Wizard of Oz too. But there is a place you can rest and where things are normal and consistent, and you can call it, you know, you can call it your own. But I think another thing it wraps into is what you were talking about, that pacifistic quality of how frivolous war is. Because the thing I probably love the most about Gone with the Wind is, as all these men are out at war, fighting.
Dying.
Yeah, outside fighting and dying, they're not running the society. They're busy in battles, and they've left the entire society they're fighting for to the women.
Right.
So suddenly, out of nowhere, women are completely running the show in all facets of existence that they, and again, you saw this during World War II. This happens really anytime all of the men leave to fucking fight each other, regress to a state where all they can think of is battle. And suddenly women are running the society. They're given all of these responsibilities that they weren't given before. In a more modern society like today, you don't think about it as, oh, the oppressed group of women finally run things. But especially back then, where women were so held back by society, suddenly there's just no one to do the things that the men were doing. So the women are given these new tasks. And you see that throughout the movie, you know, having to step up to deliver babies and to do all, not that women weren't delivering babies before, but just these things they aren't personally comfortable with. Scarlett or the women around her, skill sets they don't have, they're asked to take on, and parts of society they never had to consider before, you know, essentially whoring herself out to keep her land, you know, to preserve the things that are important to her. She might not have, she didn't have to worry previously about being the breadwinner. She was going to be a trophy. And with all of the men gone, you know, there is this constant lingering thing for her of, can I take care of myself? And I think that's the fear that leads her back over and over to these different men, or why she gets, you know, married so many different times, why she makes a dress out of curtains, which is probably one of my favorite things ever. And so there's definitely empowerment to that. There is, it's a story that is a lot of things in being as much of an epic as it is. But for me, I look at it as, you know, self-sustaining, prominent, society-defying types of women shining in these moments. And that also makes it really humorous to me that people pretend that Gone with the Wind isn't just the mainstream version of Atlas Shrugged. So now that I've upset everybody, we should talk about The Wizard of Oz.
Yep.
And I'm dying to talk about the beginning of this movie. Yeah. I didn't know if there was a place you would rather start before I go on my gleeful rant of awesomeness.
Well, I have heard that the very beginning is a very good place to start. But I think
thanks for
before
that.
We even get into that, it's probably one of the most parodied and redone pieces of historical cinema. And this is including Gone with the Wind.
Mm.
Because of its imagery, it's parts of it are so Alice in Wonderland-y, and you have this ragtag gang of easily to recreate characters. And really the thing that I think sets it apart from all those parodies, aside from it's better than all of them. Nobody can ever get The Wizard of Oz better than The Wizard of Oz got The Wizard of Oz, except maybe The Wiz, but as an exploitation lover, I have to lean toward The
Wiz.
Have you seen The Wiz with,
no, I haven't.
With Michael Jackson and Richard Pryor as the wizard?
No.
Oh, man.
It sounds amazing.
It is so good.
No. No, I know what's up next when we're done with the show.
But yeah, the thing about The Wizard of Oz is that whether it's an amalgamation of the characters, or again, maybe it's Victor Fleming. Maybe it's that talent of knowing exactly how to put a film together to make it. I mean, Gone with the Wind has never even, neither of these films have been remade, and it's 2013.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy.
You can't redo them. It can't be done. Nobody will do it better. And so now with all of that massive precipice of adoration. Please tell me about the beginning of the film.
Well, you remember back to The Wizard of Oz. You remember, you see the imagery pulled out for these parodies.
Sure.
And the part that no one ever remembers is the sepia part.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
That whole beginning chunk. And again, to go back to the movie barcode thing, you know, you're looking at it and it's big chunk of sepia that you thought was a lot shorter in your memory, a bunch of pastels, and then you're in Emerald City for a while and you leave and climb. It's really great to tell a story through just looking at these colors.
Mm-hmm.
But those sepia chunks, there's so much in there that is amazing and just brilliant. And I feel like glossed over because people think about the songs and about...
Sure.
The Somewhere Over the Rainbow part. That's the part for me, man.
Yeah.
The... you know, these painted backgrounds are just mm-hmm. fucking great. The clouds, again, apocalyptic imagery that we saw in Gone with the Wind, really showing that stuff off too during the tornado.
Uh-huh.
When it's firing up, the sound and the stage is just coming apart. So, you know, you have these sound stages that you're doing this whole farmland colorless kind of thing. And then you get to see those stages just pulled apart and destroyed. And you see that throughout The Wizard of Oz, that practical effects and the sort of magic to that.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
The costumes and the lean shoes. Everything's performance-based.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, that's something we don't talk about a lot in our evangelizing of practical effects, is the thing I like about the magic of that is that it's breathing life into the effects. There's a
sure
the performance element makes it truly unique. When you do something that's computer generated, not to rail against that or anything, but it's much more mechanical. You're basically trying all these different methods to get this one thing to look the same every time. Various pieces come together so that when you hit play, the computer generated effect looks that way, identical every time you hit it. And when you have these practical effects, so much of it is just like the rest of the movie, performance-based. You know, you have somebody in a tree suit, every time you, you know, do a take, it's going to come out completely different because of the natural human variance, that kind of variable you've added to it. So I like in the beginning, you're getting the soft intro to the characters. It's kind of these simple little Easter eggs to it. I like how much it takes on. It's like the movie knows no bounds. You know, when she's laying in the house and they have the things outside the window, she's inside the tornado.
Right.
And you're seeing all this stuff fly by her. It seems like The Wizard of Oz was not written from feasibility.
Right.
Nobody sat down to write this screenplay and went, well, what sort of things can we do in movies and how can we make The Wizard of Oz out of those? It was written like a fucking cartoon.
Right.
Well, in this scene, her house flies away in a tornado and she sees, you know, people floating by in the window as if it can just do anything. Infinite imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And then some poor fucking effects people read the screenplay and go, oh, so the house is in a tornado. What? How do we do that? Even looking at the tornado today in the background and seeing it fly around, just going, how are they accomplishing this?
Yeah.
Definitely not written because it was easy, written because it was the best part for the movie, you know, at the time, the best part for the story.
Right. Well, and the thing about The Wizard of Oz that I love is that, I mean, you hit on it when you're talking about the beginning, but the film never stops being exciting
mm-hmm.
and special. I was just having this conversation the other day about what I don't like about these new Pixar movies. And yeah, I see them because fuck you. I see Pixar movies. I really, really love the Steve Jobs, Joss Whedon one.
Sure.
Toy Story.
Yeah. The one with Penn Jillette.
Yeah. That one.
Yeah. Right.
I love Toy Story. I think it's one of the best movies in the last 20 years, 30 years.
Sure.
I think it is. I'm hard pressed to find a better animated film ever in the history of time than Toy Story, in my opinion.
Right.
However, you have a film and it immerses you in this fascinating world, very akin to The Wizard of Oz or Alice in Wonderland, you know, Over the Rainbow or Through the Looking Glass or whatever the hell you want.
Right, right.
And you get to see this world in the film. It's almost Steven Spielberg syndrome, which we talked about back on the terminal, I think,
mm-hmm.
where they paint the world and they introduce you to the characters and suddenly you go, wow, as long as there's no story, this is going to be great. And then they introduce a story. It's just a streamlined bullet through the world you saw.
Sure.
And you don't get to play around in it anymore.
Sure.
I feel like Wizard of Oz is the perfect example of how you do that.
Yeah.
How you create a story that involves the world you're in. And it allows you to go from Munchkin Land to that fucking terrifying forest of tree people.
Yeah.
Past a cornfield
Field of drugs.
Yeah. Through the field of drugs.
Yeah.
The heroin field of flowers. The Wizard of Oz knows exactly how to keep you immersed in a world that isn't the story.
Sure.
Again, to compare this to Gone with the Wind, it's about Dorothy.
Mm-hmm.
It's about this one girl who has a single set of goals and eventually finds some like-minded people who all have selfish goals, and there's one way to accomplish them.
And it happens to be walking down a road that leads you on a tour throughout the magical yeah. place that they've built.
Perfect.
How great is that?
Do you ever wonder what where the other roads go?
No, not till this very second.
When the brick roads are spiraling out of Munchkin Land.
Sure.
There are the other roads.
You're curious about the roads not taken? Is that what you're telling me?
I'm always curious about the... Well, because the one goes to Emerald City, man.
Right.
I mean, think about the destination. So the other ones have to be just as important.
I love that, too. The city,
yeah.
you know, it's a fortress. Surrounded by this giant wall, you have to get in. You know, you get in and it's got these halls and corridors. And it gets very sci-fi in that part. Also very noir in a strange way.
And steampunky.
Got kind of a Metropolis thing yep. going on in there. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
Munchkins, too. This film is totally up our alley.
Yeah,
everything about perfect. The Wizard of Oz. You know, it's funny to me, and I'm so glad this thing exists. This makes me so happy to keep finding it over and over in movies. You and I have often talked to each other, maybe not on the show, about the flick chart problem.
Flick chart problem, yeah.
Which is that The Wizard of Oz is always in your top three favorite films, yeah. no matter what, yeah. even though you don't think you're the type of person who watches The Wizard
right,
of Oz.
Right.
But you're forced to, you know, this website flick chart, you get two movies up in front of you and you're just forced to pick the one that you like more or whatever, right? Uh-huh.
For whatever reason you decide.
Yeah.
And it and can so, change.
yeah. And I don't know if this was early in the algorithm when I was doing it a lot or whatever, but The Wizard of Oz just seems to come up a lot.
Uh-huh.
And when forced to compare even movies I own versus The Wizard of Oz, which I don't, I have a hard time going, well, it's good, but it's not better than The Wizard of Oz. I mean, let's right. not get carried away or
right.
anything.
Yeah.
And so you get this idea in your head that, well, I'm not one of those people obsessed with The Wizard of Oz or anything. I mean, you know, I guess it's okay. And then I see it again for the show, and the reason that it's appealing for a mass audience, and I love it just as much as anybody else, but the reasons that it's appealing for a mass audience are not the reasons that it's appealing for me.
Right.
And we've been noticing this a lot in movies. You know, they can do these amazing things that you just adore that, well, for The Wizard of Oz, for me, it's inspiration. You know, you see all of these clever things and it's just so much creativity poured into it. And at the heart of it, I guess that's a big reason that people like it. You know, it's not the musical numbers and the characters for me so much as seeing how they're creating the film and things like the practical effects and like moving from one place to another so quickly
mm-hmm.
and just pouring all of this creativity into one place. And I go, oh yeah, all of these ideas, I'm going to step away. And I'm sure 3 years from now, I'll look back on The Wizard of Oz and I'll just remember all the stuff society tells me to remember
sure.
about it.
Sure.
And forget everything, you know, filling the spaces in between. That is really, mm-hmm. I think, kind of the magic of the movie.
Right. Well, The Wizard of Oz is one of those films that set far enough back in film history that certain things and ideas have come from The Wizard of Oz that mm-hmm. people often don't even think about when they use them in everyday conversation.
Sure.
Something like the ruby slippers and saying there's no place like home.
Yeah, right.
Something
another about, Victor theme, right?
Right.
It seems like this home stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't even think about it until she's actually clicking the heels together And I'm thinking, okay, there's definitely some commonality between this work.
Something like the I'm melting. That's just a thing.
Yeah,
people you don't think of the Wizard of Oz when somebody gets wet and you say, oh, what, you're gonna melt?
Right.
There's no rationale for that. And then you have different things like phrases like the Cowardly Lion.
Yeah.
Or people will say, if I only had a brain.
Right.
I mean, just different ideas that have permeated so deeply into our social mentality that we don't even know that it's from the Wizard of Oz anymore.
Sure, sure.
There will be children born long after we die that say things from the Wizard of Oz that they just think are colloquial phrases.
Well, what's beautiful is it's captured on film. You go back and you see it for the first time and you get the original context.
Right.
You know, watching this, I just love the surreal, perverse feeling I get from, you know, Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead.
Yeah.
Because the film, and it's just completely unintentional, but has this heavy unintended element of dark humor to it.
Sure.
It's this jubilant celebration of a person's execution.
Uh-huh.
By the time they're dragging out the death certificate prop, I just can't hold in my laughter. It's just too fucking much for me.
Well, and then there's the other big thing that I think the Wizard of Oz is known for is the man behind the curtain idea.
I was just going to say that. Yeah. My favorite theme, right?
And Well, it's
really into that Orwellian stuff.
So strong, and it's so well done in this film. I mean, every single critical aspect of the idea of a big all-knowing being, torn down and put under a magnifying glass,
but
at the same time still being this facetious creation of a human mind. It's not it's not something that 10 humans have dreamed up and it is now omnipotent. It is still the overall mental project of a single human who, as a human being, still has all the powers. They just don't have all the bells and whistles and rickety-rackety.
Well, it's funny talking about the self-driven elements of Gone with the Wind being kind of Ayn Randian, but you have that in The Wizard of Oz with religion, too, challenging just an ultimate authority. You know, I love that part about you can't see the Great Wizard. Nobody's seen the Great Wizard. At just a perfect comedic timing pause to go, but how do you know he exists?
Yeah.
And just stop wasting my time. I don't want to think about it. Those elements of questioning, not even questioning authority, but just the type of the question of magic. You know, a big thing in The Wizard of Oz is you had it inside you the whole time. The machete box that we talked about on Spy Kids.
Right.
He gives these guys all trinkets at the end of the movie, but he basically goes, you know, you have all these things that these people have. The one thing you have not is, I don't know, let me look in this bag, I guess a diploma or something. Here you go. And it basically affirms that these people, you know, do have what it takes inside them, which is this great self-earned piece of The Wizard of Oz. Everybody goes on this trip invested in themselves in the most objectivist kind of sense. And they help each other out. And it's, you know, but they're on the journey because it's serving themselves. And they get to the end and they find that they had earned these things for themselves. They don't need to ask somebody else for them. And that's taught to them, you know, this great self-made thing through tearing down the magic, through going and constantly throughout the movie, from the beginning, you know, the crystal ball scam in the beginning of the movie. Dorothy goes to a cold reading, psychics sneaking a glance at her as her photo, as they often do. And Dorothy offers up this info about, you know, measles kind of feeding into you see how cold reading's done. I also love that the guy with the crystal ball, who they're totally perpetuating as this sort of scam, offers her up, you know, information that is completely useless. Which is another, this is how you do a cold reading. You go, she's wandering around. Now she's laying on the bed, crying. This subjective or trivial moment-to-moment information. As they're going through Oz, that carries over, you know, into her fantasy of this place. All of the magic that becomes, well, it's really not about the magic. It's about you getting yourself there at the end, all the way down to the unexplainable balloon. I don't know how the balloon works. I'm going to fly away. I can't come back. I just don't know how it works. Sorry. You know, to have a movie that so honestly just unoffensively tears down superstition and magic, but is thought of as a fantasy movie, as a
right.
Oz is a place where magic happens, right? But the magic isn't important. The magic doesn't save anybody. The magic is essentially your companions who are also trying to help themselves through this. In the end, everybody earns, you know, the thing that they get.
We're off to see two more films next time. But before that,
good job.
We've got a website that's doublefeatureshow.com. If you want to email us about any of the horrendous offenses we made about classic cinema,
yeah, do that.
That's doublefeatureshow@gmail.com. You can also go to our iTunes and thumbs down all the mean stuff and thumbs up all the nice stuff and then write a mean or nice thing of your own.
I noticed on the iTunes Thursday, was this review helpful?
Uh-huh.
You know what? Reviews aren't helpful, so click no to everyone on principle. But if you want to click yes to a couple that are really nice, I would love that. Love to just scam the review system on iTunes. It's not a scam. It's a self-selected audience that we are sending to the...
Right.
That's what I want.
Some people who have already decided that the show is thumbs up worthy are our producers that we have to thank very, very sincerely for helping us out with a double feature this year. And that is Lucas Duvall, Enrique, Mike Shaw, Dust, and Eric Tachek.
Yeah, and I think this episode we did today is such a great example of the, you know, the ability to find these unspoken things in even the most well-known movies.
Mm-hmm.
So many ideas came out of this that we talked about that I'm glad this is recorded somewhere and I can remember it. So years from now, when I forget all the things I loved about these movies and only remember the classic icons, you know, I have something to go back to. What are we doing next time on the show?
We're going from the most classic of classic cinema to the two most exploity exploitation movies I think I've seen in the last year. We're going to do Ms. 45 and The Driver.
I'm excited about
that. Oh my God. If you have not seen these, you need to get on it, because if you've never seen an exploitation movie, this is really all you ever need to watch.
Yeah.
So watch more fucking film.
Bye.